we are burning down the house. Here every Thursday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Our program this evening, as always, is so far, which is a fabulous thing, sponsored by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. And did you know that they have a pro audio department? Also joining me is the co-host of Heritage Radio Network's program, The Main Course, Katie Kiefer. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Curtis. I'm wearing my architectural acolyte hat this evening. So I'm going to be grilling you on some of the standards and certifications that are rampant in the, shall we say, nomenclature of the architectural business these days.
Especially the green world. Now, the theme for this evening is the dark side of being green, because
and there is a dark side.
There are many dark sides. Gosh, where do we?
Who
start?
Who knew?
Yeah,
it all sounded so earthy, crunchy.
Well, it is earthy, crunchy, but when it comes down to it, a lot of it is just bunkum, or the appearance of being efficient or sustainable. Sustainability having many different, you know.
Well, sustainability having become sort of the buzzword.
The catchword, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it so rarely actually implies the reality of, or rather it has been used in a marketing fashion, which has voided its real meaning of being sustainable in the sense of being environmentally responsible and, you know,
and it involves
sustainable economically.
Things that anybody in their right mind would do with a building. Or in farming.
Or in agriculture,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of convergence between the worlds of the other programs on Heritage Radio Network and this program.
I was thinking as I was coming down today from Rhode Island about the fact that this is a country that goes for extremes. So in the last decade, we went for the extreme of money making and sort of the whole the madness of the markets and so forth, and everybody wanting to get really wealthy really fast with minimum effort. And now we're having this tremendous backlash, and we all want to go back to the earth, and we only want to eat sustainable local foods, and we only want to build green buildings. And nobody really has any, I shouldn't say nobody, but few people in the mainstream are really understanding what either of those things actually mean. That there's a lot more to building a green building than meets the eye, just as there is a lot more to maintaining responsible, sustainable agriculture than is obvious.
Well, sure. Recycling, for example, which we have to accommodate in residential buildings now because you can't just throw everything down the trash chute. You have to have recycling bins in the trash chute rooms.
Right. And I always feel very worthy when I bring my properly segregated trash down to the trash room.
Well, considering you're friends with your super, he would know your trash. And
yeah.
And if you got him
busted.
But
even up in Rhode Island, when I had to go to the dump, because we don't have cartage there, everything had to be segregated into its appropriate categories.
And that's a good thing.
And it was a good thing, yeah. And it was really not so hard to do. But, I can remember when my mother had cartage and she would just, and there were certain guys who would come in and they would just like throw it all together in the back of the truck. Oh, yeah, we're separating it. Don't worry about it, Mrs. Kiefer. No problem.
Oh, that's really sustainable.
And they were probably carting it off to some, illegal dump sustained by a mafiosi member of the Rhode Island cabal.
Well, I'm glad you brought up dumps, because one of the things that perpetually frightens me or irritates me is modern age we have where certain kinds of batteries, electronic batteries, can't be or shouldn't be, under New York law, put in with the regular trash.
That's right.
For example, the rechargeable batteries that are in cell phones.
Well, I don't think any batteries are allowed to go into the trash, theoretically. Of course, I know that everybody, including myself, has been guilty of doing that.
I in your packet of information, you will find
which I have not completely finished reading.
In your cheat sheets, you'll find a whole declension of different types of batteries that can and cannot be put in the ordinary trash. For example, alkaline batteries can go in the trash in New York, but rechargeable lithium batteries cannot.
Well, lithium being a heavy metal.
Yes, it's a heavy toxic metal. However, New York City's solution to that is that you, as the post-consumer electronic consumer, it's your responsibility to find
somebody who's going to take that lithium battery and dispose of it responsibly.
Exactly. To take that battery to Staples or to Verizon Wireless and say, hey, I bought this phone from you. Here's the battery. You know,
yeah, I'm going to do that.
You know, screw you. I'm out of here. I'm leaving it on the counter and I'm running for the door.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's no municipal system yet for collecting these things. And
well, let's talk about what happens when they do go into the trash.
Well, eventually they interact with water, and those heavy metals leach into the soils that are under the garbage dump.
The landfill. Well, because it goes to a landfill, right?
Yeah. Well, in the case of... for example, in the case of the huge garbage dump that's in Staten Island, they have occasionally opened that up, and they found that because there's no oxygen, you can find perfectly fresh hot dogs from 1962 in there with the Daily News in the garbage dump.
Really?
Because there's no...
There's no composting effect?
No.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. But there is water in there, and so the batteries will eventually rust or corrode.
Sure.
And the heavy metals will
seep down.
Well,
they rust and corrode in your freezer. I know that people thought for many years that you were supposed to keep batteries in the freezer, and then about 2 years ago.
Yeah, but it's moist. But it's moist in there, so yeah, they do corrode.
It's wrong. Yeah. You're not supposed to keep them in the freezer.
Well, so.
Because they do corrode.
Yeah, that's right. Now, one of the things that caught my attention in the recent news, the environment news, is that the European Union, as of this Monday, September 1st, that just passed, has banned the manufacture, sale, and importation of standard Edison incandescent light bulbs, what we have all grown up with. The pear-shaped, which is called an A-bulb, a light bulb with a tungsten filament, which uses a lot of energy, a lot of electrical energy to produce light, produces also a lot of heat because that filament is
hot.
Yeah, it's not burning, but it is slowly oxidizing at about 8,000 degrees in either a vacuum or a noble gas like argon. And so in the EU, you cannot buy 75
watts. You will no longer be able to buy
75 watts or higher and by March of next year, no incandescent A-bulbs of the Edison type whatsoever anymore.
So now, what's going to happen to everyone's light fixtures? I mean,
it's a problem because some light fixtures will not accept the new modern compact fluorescent
lamp. CFL.
Right, the CFL, you know, which looks like a Dairy Queen snow cone.
Well, back in the day, I remember when Con Ed was giving those out for free to encourage people to start using those long-use bulbs.
And in terms of energy consumption, it's a very good idea because they use perhaps 20% as much electricity to produce the same amount of lumens of illumination as compared with an Edison-style incandescent lamp. And they don't produce as much heat, which reduces in the summertime the air conditioning load. Or in New York City, where we have very large buildings, we also have cooling loads in the wintertime.
Right.
You know, office buildings have to have cooling in the wintertime in the core areas.
Core areas being where you store your computer servers.
In the middle of the building.
Uh-huh.
Usually where the stairs and the elevators are, it gets very hot. The exterior areas of a floor, say in an office building, because it's exposed to the weather, will be more cool, but they'll have to bring cold air or cooler air into the center of the building. Anyway, so it's a very good idea in terms of decreasing the amount of electrical power for the same amount of illumination. And that's a good thing.
Sure, you can argue with that.
And also,
it's a beautiful thing.
Well, yes. Well, you can argue with it.
Okay, no, let's hear what the argument is.
There's the upsides and there's the downsides. A standard incandescent lamp lasts about 1,000 to 1,100 hours.
As opposed to a CFL, which lasts?
Oh, 15 to 17,000 hours.
Okay, all right, so that sounds really good.
So there's your saving in life cycle. So even though CFLs cost a little bit more right now. And funny story. In Germany, because the Germans, according to popular mythology, are notorious penny pinchers. There's been hoarding of incandescent lamps.
Really?
Yes. This year, light bulb sales went
People
up.
People have been going on eBay and buying up huge the lots of
light bulb sales went up 35%.
Really?
Yeah. In 2009. Because they're cheap, you know, they're cheap compared with a CFL, which is funny. And where there will be other...
But they are not cheap if you think about the fact that that they don't last as long. So, I mean, the only problem... I mean, I haven't had a problem converting my lamp. I mean, my lamps have all taken, and I have an old... As you know, I have an old house that was built around the turn of the 20th century. And there hasn't been any problem in substituting CFLs for incandescent lights. So
there will be some problems. Very small lamps, like in your dryer, your oven.
Oh, yeah. Right. There you go. Solution. Refrigerator. Yeah.
Sure. Well, the solution to those will be that people will make multiple LED style screw-in lamps that will fit in smaller spaces. Those aren't in the market yet, but they're coming.
Uh-huh.
That technology.
So GE is on top of that.
Oh, GE. GE makes. I know. GE does make light bulbs still, but Sylvania Osram bought Westinghouse.
Right, Sylvania. Yeah. Their
brand name is Osram. OSRAM, and they're arguably the largest light bulb producer in the world. They're all over the map.
GTE Sylvania,
and they're on top of that, right? Yeah, and. And that's where Westinghouse went, in case you were wondering.
I was wondering because I have a visual image of the A bulb with the W on it.
Yeah, well,
absolutely.
That got sucked into the Sylvania world.
Uh-huh.
Then there's Philips. Philips is also a very large light bulb manufacturer. But part of the dark side is that the CFLs, like all other fluorescent lamps, have mercury in them.
Right.
So the
fluorescent track lights that we've all been using in our kitchens and in office buildings, lo these many years, are all powered with a mercury component.
You don't mean a track light. You just mean a light.
I mean a light. I mean a fluorescent tube.
Oh, yeah. You mean the landlord's halo, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they have significant amounts
of mercury,
in them. Uh-huh. Sure.
And
Now, per lamp, it's not a great deal. In a CFL, the amount of mercury is about the size of the rollerball in a Bic pen. It's
okay.
A little tiny bit of mercury. But if you multiply that out, I read a statistic today that...
Well, you have an amazing list of statistics here in my cheat sheet.
Yeah, well, according to one source...
2 billion light bulbs
were bought a year.
5.5 million every day.
Right. Now, if CFLs last 15 times or 17 times longer, that's still over 170 million lamps being bought and then discarded every
year. It says here in my cheat sheet, 142,857,143 CFL bulbs are discarded per annum.
That's a funny approximation.
5 milligrams of HG. Am I assuming HG is the mercury?
Yeah, that's,
okay.
Didn't you ever take chemistry?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
In spite of my fancy private school education, no, I managed to skip chemistry. And as you know, I didn't go to college. So.
Yes, okay. That's mercury. And if you add that
all up. So that's 324,675 pounds of mercury per year.
Released into garbage dumps because no one is regulating CFLs as a hazardous product, which gets around to, you know, a fraction of a gram, and a gram is not very much weight. You know, a little sachet of
hash.
I was thinking, you know, the aspartame stuff. That, you know, yeah. What's that?
No,
called?
I was thinking in terms of an aging hippie.
No, you're the person who.
It's like where you buy things in grams. It's only you know, drugs are only 1 gram.
But also artificial sweeteners come in grams.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't use those.
Well, I think 1 gram of, what's it called? You know, the stuff comes into pink.
Sweetina.
The aspartame stuff.
Yeah, that's the pink thing.
That's a gram. So for every person in the United States, if we figure that there's 350 million people in the United States, there's enough for each of us to get mercury poisoning every year.
Oh, yeah. Let's look at the toxicity of mercury here. Here's another piece of cheat sheet material. I'm not sure if this actually told us how much it
doesn't
takes
tell
for you
how
to
much it takes
poisoned.
For you to get poisoned.
It just tells you how devastating an effect methylmercury, which winds up in our agricultural system
through fish
and through groundwater. Because I imagine if you start spraying crops with water that has been contaminated with mercury, that eventually at least some of those plant materials are going to absorb some mercury levels.
Well, why wouldn't it? I mean, E. coli spreads that way also.
It's a different kind of compound, though. E. coli is a bacteria, and you're talking about a heavy metal.
Well, at least bacteria can break down when they're exposed to
air.
The sun and ultraviolet, whereas mercury, especially methylmercury, stays toxic
indefinitely.
Forever.
Yeah. There's never a time when it's not toxic. As an aside, I should tell you that when my mother was a small child, this was in the 1920s, her doctor used to give her, and I don't know why he had a supply of mercury, but he would periodically give her like a little tube of mercury to play with.
Of course.
Yeah. Because you could play with it.
Well,
you could drop it in a dish and it would break into little droplets and then you could push it together with your finger.
Oh, absolutely.
And then put your finger in your mouth or pick your nose or whatever.
as it turns out, elemental mercury passes through the gut without being absorbed.
Ah, so not toxic. It's only when it's converted into methylmercury
that
it becomes toxic to the human body.
When I was a boy and my father was a civilian in the Department of Defense, he would bring home interesting
high-tech
stuff.
Oh, really? You got that too, huh?
Oh, yeah. And so he would bring home these silver mercury batteries that were left over from, I don't know, mock-ups of high-tech equipment that he was involved with. And I, being me, would get to say
you being you.
Yeah, you, me,
Oh, chemistry nerd boy.
Yeah, but I also like to take things apart.
Yes.
How do you know how it works if you don't take it apart? Of course, it doesn't really matter if you put it back together again because, you know, it's just part of the learning experience. So I would take the hacksaw and I would saw these batteries open and I would extract the mercury.
And do what with it?
Until I got a nice big blob so I could play with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, then. So that's in the 50s.
Yes, that was in the 50s. That was...
Not to date you too completely, darling.
Or the early 60s. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. In the middle... In the late part of the middle
in
20th
the
century.
In the mid part of the 20th century.
So this mercury will end up in garbage dumps. Now, in New York City, as I understand, and if people want to send me an email to say that I'm just full of bull, please do. magisterarch@gmail.com. However, I believe that the inert component of New York trash ends up getting dumped in the ocean. And that means that the ground up bits of CFLs, compact fluorescent lights, will end up being dumped in the ocean, and that mercury will go into the water and it will get into the fish. And so over time, as
it will be getting into us.
Yes, as the United States converts to compact fluorescent lamps, because the big trend right now is that we must conform our constitution to international law, and we must do what the Europeans do, because to a certain extent, Americans still, in my opinion, remain colonial puppets of European intellectual superiority. So if they're doing it, we must do it.
Curtis.
Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't disagree.
Oh, absolutely.
Colonial puppets. Are you kidding? We're dictating what everybody else does.
Yeah, but when it comes down to it, wouldn't you rather have a nice stinky French cheese than one of Anne Saxelby's,
artisanal
Vermont cheeses?
No, not necessarily, because I think artisanal cheese in this country is coming a long way. I think that's actually a bad analogy. I think a more apt. I think back to the beginning of the Green Party in Germany, which was way back in the 60s or 70s, early 70s, and Americans were way, way behind the curve on that. It was a long time ago that the Europeans started picking up on these trends and changing the way they do business, which brings us to the point that I think is one of the most interesting research.
I just want to say something about the Green Party, which had close alliances with the Bader-Meinhof terrorist cell, and we didn't.
Don't know that that's true.
That is true.
I noticed in the New Yorker this week, actually, there's a new film about the Bader-Meinhof gang.
That's right. These are the people, for those listeners of you who grew up
a little later than
in recent time, the Bader-Meinhof gang blew up a lot of nightclubs as a protest against the Vietnam War.
Among other things.
Among other things.
Yes, they had many grievances.
And many of their grievances were very similar to the Weather Underground who blew up things, including themselves, in one case where they were building bombs in the basement of a townhouse on West 12th Street, and things went awry, and they blew themselves up.
But those
people are all totally now...
And one of those people is now teaching at Columbia University.
That's right. They're now politically rehabilitated.
And, yes, Kathy Boudin, now a professor at Columbia, and and Angela Davis, also thoroughly rehabilitated, and a professor at, I can't remember
that's
quite
right.
where.
That's right. My daughter Allison's
good University
friend,
of Chicago.
Well, her former roommate, Nick, is studying rhetorical philosophy, a PhD program at Berkeley, and Angela Davis
at Berkeley, of course.
Thesis advisor, which what? Is it. But we digress away from the built environment.
Yes, right. so that we can argue about the radical environment.
The Bader-Meinhof. It was just kind of fun to say Bader-Meinhof. Anyway, and I don't even know what that means.
I didn't study German.
Well, the...
something else, but...
The interesting statistic here, in terms of the dark side of geopolitical machinations, is something worthy of Count Metternich, who was this political mover and shaker in the 19th century in Europe.
In Prussia.
Yes. Is that the estimate published by the European Union, the EU, of the amount of electrical energy that will be saved by converting to CFLs is 40...
trillion
terawatts. That's 40 billion kilowatts. If you look at your electric bill, you'll see that it's assessed in kilowatts. So it's 40 billion kilowatts, which doing a
40 terawatts is enough to power a small country.
Yeah, the output of the country of Taiwan, the island country of Taiwan, is about 40 terawatts a year. And that also happens to be the statistic that I found, without having to dig particularly hard, of the amount of electricity that Russia expects to sell to China in 2015. And so I say that this is as much about Europe's interest in competing with Russia in terms of selling electricity to China.
Because the EU, and especially France, is generating much of their electrical power through nuclear power.
And
already online. They've already got that going on.
Yeah, but there's no money to be building new electrical plants.
They don't
plants.
Need to, because if they reduce their footprint by 40 terawatts...
If they save 40 terawatts...
they can keep their infrastructure as is and make the extra money up.
And so now what we have is...
This is an energy commerce battle.
Merchant states.
But isn't
selling
that where
electricity?
We're all going? Because it's going to be the same thing with water.
Well, that's true. We're right now at peak water. The way that we were at peak oil right after World War II, where water was, gasoline was cheap as water. Now water is cheap as water, but in the coming
years. Very soon, water is going to be the number one trading commodity.
Which we cannot do without.
Yeah.
And desalinization is incredibly expensive.
Well, nobody seems to have really turned their attention sufficiently to creating desalinization plants that are viable economically and that really produce the kind of volume that is necessary to sustain agriculture. Because we all know it's all going to agriculture. And on the main course in coming weeks, on Sundays, I hope to have Dixon Despommiers from Columbia University, who had an op-ed in the Times last week about urban vertical farming and the rise of farming with hydroponics and, you know, the reduction of giant ag farming as we know it today, using up great vast tracts of land.
So in other words, the Salinas Valley in California will either have enormous quantity of wind turbines,
yeah,
or many small nuclear or atomic, as we used to call it in the 1950s,
yeah,
atomic power plants, which are much safer than they used to be. France doesn't have the problem that we do emotionally about having nuclear power.
And they haven't had any accidents, or at least not any that they're copping to.
Well, I think in this world
of the
internet world, and we'll come back and talk about internet and server farms and electricity in the next segment. But it's a good idea to save electricity, but it sounds like the EU really wants to be selling it to China.
Yeah.
So let's take a break and have a song about money. Built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Katie Kiefer, co-host of The Main Courses, joining us.
Yeah, joining the conversation about design.
We're talking about
environment.
The dark side of being green, part one.
Yeah, nobody wants to believe that there is a dark side, but of course there is, because nothing is ever black or white.
There is no free lunch.
No, there is no free
lunch. You gotta buy a beer.
Everything comes at a cost.
That's right.
Everything.
Now, in this internet, here's another interesting thing that I uncovered in my research. Because, that's what I, you know me, that's what I do all day. I just do research. And there's so much to learn.
It's so much.
The more you learn, the more you realize you don't know anything.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Socrates.
Yeah.
I love the Socratic method, asking pointed questions. It's so great.
Well, you don't ask questions, you don't learn nothing.
That's true. If I mean, just take life as a given, you're going to be Forrest Gump.
Yeah, nothing ever changes.
And life is not a box of chocolates. Anyway, one of the interesting things that I found from the Department of Energy, that's the U.S. DOE, is that server farms, data centers, use a huge amount of power compared with any other building type.
That means like Google?
Like Google, for example.
As a prime example.
Has huge, probably the world's
they
largest.
They are the largest, I think, the
server
largest
farms.
Server. Yeah.
All of those little disks spinning, 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 spinning have to be cooled. And the energy consumption of a data center is 40% of that building's consumption.
Overall energy consumption.
Yeah, and you got the stats over there. Maybe you could find those. That was very interesting. I forget if it was 10 times more than a normal building or...
Where is that, baby?
100.
Oh, data center energy. Yeah, here's
yeah,
the
DOE
report.
And they said...
I don't know. I think I'm going to have to give this to you because you had more of a chance to review this than I did. I'm bogged down on the household battery fact sheet here.
Well, let's let's just change the subject. Let's talk about LEED, the U.S.
Okay, because that's, I mean, that goes
yeah,
back to the same thing.
The
because everything has to
be Green
LED.
Buildings
yeah.
Council.
And that's
which, by the way.
And every office building has a data server center. Every office building now has an enormous complex of computerized equipment, which requires an enormous amount of consumption. So when you're designing a building, here's my question for you. When you're designing an office building, how do you calculate the amount of energy required, the level of cooling required or the level of power required, and how do you build that into the infrastructure of the building when you're designing a building from the outset?
We take the specifics of the equipment going in. How many watts?
So every company has to give you, before you build a building for, say, I don't know, Time Life or Condé Nast. I mean, just to think about buildings that have gone up here in New York, the New York Times building,
for instance.
We
take the data on the equipment that's going in the room.
Uh-huh.
We know the wattage of the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way to extract mathematically how much heat that will generate depending on the efficiency of the equipment. Different equipment creates heat at different rates.
Sure.
It's called a power factor. I think that in the algebraic is like a capital I or something like that. Motors, for example, operate at 80% efficiency. The other 20% becomes heat. So
uh-huh.
If you have a 100 watt motor, 20 watts worth of power becomes heat. And there's a way to calculate how many calories or joules, if you're working in the metric system, or BTUs, is thrown off into the environment. And we sum it all up, and we adjust for the relative humidity of the room, which is sensible heat. And we size the...
What would create humidity in a room that was full of machines?
The door is open.
And how much humidity is... I mean, do you want... It doesn't create humidity on its own. It's only environmental factors that intrude on that machine room.
You want 50% humidity.
For a machine to operate successfully.
You don't want too little, because then you have the potential of sparking. If someone comes in and touches something, you have static electricity builds up in lower humidity. And technicians do not always ground themselves with a little strap before they touch things, and you could end up frying circuit boards or
So if you don't allow for that 50% humidity factor, then you're going to have problems with your personnel.
With failure of equipment, mm-hmm. It ranges between 30 and 60%. Humidity control is not an exact science, even at this day and age in buildings. Libraries like a little bit more humidity because paper likes to be damp. If it gets too dry, it starts to fall out.
Yeah, it crisps.
Yeah.
So in too much,
you start to get mold.
Yeah. So in the context of LEED, L-E-E-D, which is leadership in energy
and efficiency
design.
Yes.
In the context of LEED, so how does LEED differ from the status quo or what has been up to the last 5 years?
Well,
say?
some would have you believe that LEED is a sham because the U.S. Green Buildings Council, which has promulgated the standards for LEED, is a self-electing group. Anybody can join, and most of the members are participants in the construction industry. So it's the construction industry telling the construction industry what to do. Now, there's some good sides to this, which is that prior to there being this green buildings movement, if you had a product that was a little bit more expensive because it was made out of reclaimed or recycled materials, getting it sold was difficult because people would say, well, it's more expensive, I'm not going to use it. I don't really care if your particle board has no or very low VOCs, volatile organic compounds, the things that outgas from carpet, wall coverings, floor coverings, and make people sick, especially now that we have buildings that are sealed, where there's no infiltration of air, and the air is trapped. VOCs are bad. And they give you headaches. When you go into a space that has new carpet and it has high VOC, you'll get a headache. Or the adhesives, you'll smell those.
And those high VOCs are caused by chemicals from which these materials are manufactured.
Yeah, volatile, or that is to say, unstable mm-hmm. organic compounds.
Are they organic, or are they? Or does organic also cover petroleum products? Because
petroleum,
I know that,
is
a lot of carpet is made of petroleum.
Of course,
products, plastics.
It's all made. It's all made out of petroleum.
Uh-huh.
Petroleum is organic. It's millennia old plant material that metamorphosized from being mulch into this thick, sludgy stuff that we refine into petroleum. So all plastics are petroleum based. Your nylon stockings are the same stuff as the gasoline that you put in the tank in your car.
And your polyester sheets are the same stuff as
absolutely.
You put in your car.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So in the future, when
no
we
wonder we like pure cotton sheets.
Yeah, because otherwise you're wearing lubricant, you know.
Not always a bad idea, but okay.
Which is why it sweats. I mean, you
that's
know,
right. That's why it doesn't breathe.
Yeah, I mean, you could, you know, you can wear a.
But what about those products
really
that wick away your moisture? Are those or what are those?
Those are those are just better engineered
polymers,
long chain polymers.
They're polymers,
yeah. That came from petrochemicals.
Yeah.
Petro, meaning rock, rocks that give up oil and...
oil or natural gas. Yeah.
Yeah, like in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, so named because there were oily rocks not far right. from where they first...
Well, now in Pennsylvania, they have the whole Marcellus Shale deposit, which from which we are going to start to extract a great deal of petroleum product. Pennsylvanians, I hope you're ready for those drillers to start building those rigs in your backyard, because that's about to happen to you.
Well, I don't know that they're going to drill. They probably will strip mine. That's what happened to my ancestors' farm in Slippery Rock. The heirs to the property, and my great-great-grandfather was born there, and his father, and there were these five or six farms in Slippery Rock, all adjacent to each other. And they sat on very good coal land, but it was low-grade coal, and you wouldn't mine it, you would strip mine it. So the heirs, who were more or less my age, didn't want to be farmers anymore. So they sold out the mineral rights, and the old 18th-century farmhouses were torn down, and the land was raped. It was laid open, the open-pit strip mines happened, and then when all the coal was removed, they pushed dirt around and replanted it, and now it's just empty fields and no one's farming it because my many times removed cousins got the money and they don't want to come back and be farmers anymore.
Well, you know, as we all know, farming is something that has to be, I mean, unless you're in the mega agribusiness, farming has to be in your blood for you to want to work that hard for that little money.
And farming in Western Pennsylvania in the...
Unless you're a Mennonite.
In the, yeah, well, these people were not, they were Presbyterians, was to a great degree subsistence farming. Yeah, they sold some oats from time to time, and yeah, they enjoyed the farm subsidies. But back to LEED. The thing about LEED is that it's a prescriptive way of estimating the performance of a building. You get points, and you add up enough points, and then you're either certified silver, gold, or platinum. LEED does not require you to then measure the actual performance of a building in terms of energy consumption, because LEED also addresses things like the use of low VOC materials,
mm-hmm. Energy efficient appliances.
Well, no, that's Energy Star. LEED. Oh. Well, yeah, you can.
Yeah,
you get, you
that's
get,
LEED. I mean, you get LEED points, right, LEED. For using energy efficient equipment.
Yes, yes.
For having a better lighting or cooling or heating system.
You also get LEED points for preventing air infiltration, for preventing moisture infiltration. Moisture being very key to controlling or preventing mold blooms. Now, one of the interesting things is that in the 20th century, mold did not seem to be a problem because buildings were, it was understood that buildings breathed. When I learned heating and ventilating engineering in architecture school in the 1970s, we factored in infiltration, which is the amount of air that leaks in around windows and doors. Now we're able to prevent any infiltration. And so that stagnant air, unless it's
circulated properly
in some other way by
or cleaned,
has created a whole generation of buildings where mold just goes nuts, and mold is very irritating to humans and animals. It's not fatally toxic, but it definitely kicks off many people's immune responses. So they're miserable, and they can't live in these buildings, and the mold starts to grow on any cellulose-containing material, which includes gypsum board drywall, because it's a layer of gypsum with paper on both sides, wood trim. Anything that has a plant
even material. Metal will grow mold. I mean, plastics will grow mold
if they have been handled and
sure.
And there's oil,
some sort of residue that
the mold will grow on almost anything under almost any circumstances. Mold will can be frozen and will regenerate when it gets back to a certain temperature and humidity. So LEED encourages controlling the amount of moisture that comes into a building and encourages the use of daylight. And these are all sustainable factors that have been ignored in the era of cheap energy that we all grew up in. But LEED does not give points for being innovative. There are ways, for example, to cool buildings by using the effects of convection, like the draft in a furnace, a fireplace,
right,
will draw hot air out of a building,
right, and you can shoot it up to the top of the building and send it out.
And traditional architecture in desert areas, and many cultures, like in northern Iran, they have buildings with great flue-like structures that draw out the hot air. And so people were able to live in the desert and have a movement of air and a natural cooling effect. It required no
Well, it's like the termite mounds in Africa, where you see these enormous termite hotels that are you know, 10s of 12s, 15 feet more, 30 feet tall.
Exactly.
With these flues that gas out all the hot air. Otherwise, the insects would die.
It's all part of just natural energy of weather.
Yeah.
And we don't get any points in lead for that.
No.
No.
Huh. I didn't know that.
No. We don't, which leads some critics of LEED to say that LEED gives an appearance of energy efficiency, but not the reality. And there have been debates back and forth. We're going to, in a future show, we'll get...
Henry Gifford will be on the show.
We'll have him in.
He's written a very interesting article about LEED and a better way to rate green buildings. I have this in the... what is this publication?
It's from henrygifford.com.
.com, yeah. And he's covered many of these issues.
And he's quite outspoken. And he's gone head-to-head with
the... extensive bibliography here, by the way.
Yeah, he's gone head-to-head with the U.S. Green Buildings Council, who decries him as a...
A spoil sport,
Philistine and mountebank.
Well, let's talk for a
minute. And by the way, we don't like you either.
But let's talk for a minute about the impact of LEED on construction marketing, on how people sell buildings and how they're able to sell buildings at a higher price by saying that they are incorporating quote unquote LEED practices into their buildings without necessarily actually doing anything terribly different from what has been the status quo in the past.
They haven't, but LEED gives you a way to put metrics to measure.
So you can say, well, my building is LEED for all the environmentally conscious consumers who want to do the right thing.
You can't say it unless you put together all the paperwork and send it to the USGBC.
And then the USGBC is what?
The United States Green Building Council. This,
okay.
This self-referential consortium of anybody who wants to belong can belong, and mostly it's the big industrial producers of construction materials who are the big contributors.
That's right. And
yeah.
Who put their people in place.
As tastemakers.
Yeah.
So if you put together all of the documentation, you send it to Washington, and they'll send you back a plaque for your building.
And then you can then turn around to your consumer and say,
it's a LEED building.
This is a LEED certified building, so therefore you can expect to pay on just ballpark.
That's interesting, Katie. That will be another future program.
No, but just ballpark. Much more can you charge for LEED space than you could for conventional material?
I'm not sure that you can.
Really?
Yeah.
But I think that's a tremendous marketing tool. I mean, I certainly see that just as a consumer and an uneducated consumer at that. But looking at, if you look at commercial real estate ads or read anything about commercial real estate or people who are developing buildings, when you're developing residential properties, for example, you want to be able to say it's LEED certified. And I'll betcha.
I bet you that commands a higher price point. I want to get people in from the related companies who have developed several properties here in New York in Battery Park City, which Battery Park City is an interesting place because they don't refer to LEED, but they do have, and in one of our previous programs, a LEED specialist from Stephen Winter Associates came in and spoke briefly about this. Battery Park City has their own green guidelines that every new development in Battery Park City has to conform to, and they exceed the LEED requirements, and they include things like renewable materials like bamboo. Although bamboo flooring, for example, itself, that's total bunkum because it has bamboo in it, but in order to turn bamboo, which is a circular reed, into a flat flooring, you have to embed it in plastic.
Uh-huh.
So a bamboo floor is resin, back to the petrochemicals again, that happens to contain
some bamboo.
Bamboo. I mean, you could make flooring that had hair clippings from JoJo's...
Poodle parlor.
Exactly. Poodle parlor, hair salon. You could have natural hair flooring with resin, and it would be just as natural as bamboo flooring.
Right.
Because what holds it together is are these long chain polymers that come from petrochemicals. So the bamboo's just a filler.
What about green roofs? That's a big new thing that's
well,
happening.
Well, yes, the
let's
planted,
talk about that
the
for a
planted
minute.
Roof.
And what is the impact of that on somebody's building, and how does that help with the heating and cooling system?
Well, I think we should take a break. Again, I'd like to say that this is Burning Down the House, sponsored by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to
We're
the Macintosh computer.
We're just having too much fun.
Let's take a little break, and we'll talk again.
We'll be back about green roofs.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves, when I think it could be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over 'cause you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring, and green can be cool and friendly-like, and green can be big like a mountain, or important like a river, or tall like a tree. When green.
Welcome back to Sesame Street. Oh, I'm sorry. We are burning down the house over the dark side of green architecture. Curtis Wayne and
Katie Kiefer.
And you brought up green roofs. Now, in the beginning, I mean, everybody here has been reading about green roofs. Mayor Richie Daley in Chicago has mandated that all Chicago
city
buildings...
I thought that was a very interesting development. Yes.
It is. Well, he can do that in Chicago because Chicago has a political autocracy, and what they want to do, they do. Case in point, the ban on foie gras, which eventually then they rescinded because it was stupid. But green roofs are not stupid. Now, there's nothing new about a planted roof. Sod houses in the American West.
Absolutely. It was the most energy efficient way of keeping your house cool in the summer and warm in the winter.
And the prairie grasses just grew over the sod.
Anybody who read the Little House series by Laura Ingalls Wilder knows that.
Yes. Well, I didn't, but I'm sure all you girls
well,
out there did.
Well, that's where I learned about it. I thought it was a really cool idea, and I still do. But now, in terms of New York City, say, or urban architecture, not just New York City, but urban architecture in general.
Well, case in point, about the green roofs. Both, architecturally speaking, both Oliver Aalto and Le Corbusier did green roofs experimentally on some of their projects.
When was that?
In the 1940s and 50s.
So a good long while ago, long before anybody was really thinking in terms of lead.
Not at all. I don't know why Corbu decided to do this, but on the Maison Jaoul, a pair of houses in suburban Neuilly. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, Neuilly, yeah.
Just on the edge
Très
of Paris.
Très bien.
Merci.
Mon gars.
On the outskirts of Paris. You can get there if you take the metro and walk for about 20 minutes. He has planted roofs, green roofs, but the structure to support them is very robust. It's very heavy concrete arches. And that's something that needs to be taken into consideration. You can't just take your ordinary roof
and put 5,000 pounds of sod on it.
Yeah.
And grow a bunch of plants.
And now a recent trend is to repurpose roof area in the Brooklyn post-industrial landscape, where we have lots and lots of industrial loft buildings and factories, and plant them with crops, just as we have here. Your listeners may hear tromping noises. These are happy people upstairs.
On top of the shipping containers which this studio is housed.
That's right. Walking around and sniffing the essence of
growing tomatoes.
Tomatoes and peppers and such. So we have actually not only a green roof, but an agricultural roof here in raised beds. So, yes, you can. If every roof in New York was planted, it would be a wonderful thing. However, dirt is heavy. Dirt with water, which you need for agriculture, is even heavier.
But why do you even want that? I mean, obviously, people would like to grow crops on their roofs, and it's all idea to grow your own vegetables up top. But what are the energy? What is it about that that creates a more energy efficient environment? I mean, that to me is sort of the crux of the matter. It's like, it's cute to grow your corn upstairs, but it's
dirt is a really,
what does it really do?
Dirt's a really good or earth. Reminds me of, I just have to say this. I remember many years ago at the Green Market, a woman in a heated conversation with a farmer, and she was shaking a pepper at him, and he was saying, "Madam, it's not dirt, it's earth. It grew in it." "But it's dirty."
Well, we're not used to getting our food with earth still clinging to it, or dirt. It's all supposed to be very shiny and waxed, especially produce.
Maybe it was a potato. I don't know.
Well, even
peppers,
so.
Peppers don't usually lie in the dirt. Anyway, dirt is a really good insulator, or let's say it does not transmit heat from the sun efficiently. So if the sun is beating down on your tar paper roof, which is a typical row house, apartment house,
Absolutely, that's what's
story.
On top of my apartment building, seven
right.
stories tall on the Upper West Side. We got right. a tar paper roof.
Right. It's a very efficient transmitter of the insolation. That's what it's called. The incoming infrared component of sunlight becomes heat, and it transmits into the structure of the building.
Right.
And so the people on the top floor get cooked, and the people on the floor below get a little less cooked, and so forth. So dirt, earth, soil. Of course, there are many soils. We could talk about that. Or the farmers could talk about the soil. But as an architect, I can talk about soil, because soil is, topsoil is humus, which is decomposed organic material. But there are other soil components, such as sand, clay, rock, particles. All that gets mixed together. That's all soil. And each of those components has a function in terms of being good soil for agriculture. Clay has nutrients. The sand allows water to percolate through. Rocks and aggregate allow, at the bottom strata, water to collect and then percolate back up through the layer of soil. But soil itself is good on a roof because it's an inefficient transmitter of insulation energy.
So, in other words, it'll keep your building cooler in the summer and presumably warmer in the winter, because it will keep the heat from escaping through that top strata as heat rises.
Because this low wavelength infrared energy cannot be transmitted through that layer.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever depth of soil that you have that you're growing things is good. Now, the first generation of green roofs, like at Battery Park City, will have 12 to 14 inches of soil, which is enough to support the growth of ornamental grasses that do not require a great deal of
water.
Irrigation. Now, another aspect of...
very busy up there.
Oh, my God. They're doing clog dancing up there. should play some polka music for them. We could get some.
But what
rhythm
does it
going.
Mean? I mean, in terms of the cost of building a structure to support a green roof, because as you mentioned earlier in this segment when we first started talking about this, you can't just throw a load of topsoil on top of the roof of any old post-industrial building and assume that the structure is going to be able to carry it. So
no, it won't, because it will have been designed for a snow load.
Yeah.
Of
whatever,
20 or 30 pounds per square foot.
Whereas earth is
80 to 100 pounds if it's saturated.
So then, in fact, it costs the outside cost. I mean, I guess the ratio that you would want to come up with is how much more does it cost to build a building that can support that load versus the cost that you save in terms of heating and cooling
well,
the building?
That's the equation.
Look,
in the overall first cost of construction, reinforcing your roof is not significant. A structural cost.
So, in other words, there's no reason not to implement this on a wide level.
If it makes
such a difference in terms of the energy costs over of the building,
over
the lifetime of the building,
over the 100 to 120 year life cycle of a contemporary building, it's negligible.
So this is a part of LEED. I mean that
of the green buildings movement.
Yeah, of the green buildings movement. That is a very worthy aspect of it, which does not impose a huge cost on the constructor. In other words, the developer, whoever is building the structure.
No, it doesn't.
But then ultimately saves both the owner of that building as well as the tenants a significant cost in terms of energy efficiency.
And furthermore, going forward, as we become more tolerant, is the only word that I can use, as regards the reuse of water that has not been sterilized and fluoridated and chlorinated. What I'm talking about is gray water, the water that comes out of showers and out of sinks.
Washing machines.
Well, washing machines are a different case
because it has the soap.
Not so much soap in a shower, not so much soap in a sink. We will see increasingly, even on a residential level, in ordinary single family houses, certainly in apartment houses, the collection of gray water to use as an irrigant for the green roofs. Now that's been implemented in all the buildings over the last 8 or 10 years at Battery Park City. In that particular instance, they go a little bit overboard. These buildings have their own sewage treatment plants in their basements, producing what would be otherwise potable water, but then they dope it with a tincture of blue so it looks like the Tidy Bowl water.
Really?
And then they'll reuse that as irrigation water or as maintenance water to wash the sidewalks. And then the excess they discharge into the city sewer system, but it's perfectly clean and reduces the amount of sludge going into the sewer system.
Right.
Now, of course, these buildings eventually, over time, have to have the sediment sucked
collected
out.
And removed.
The honeysucker trucks have to come and remove the sludge.
Oh, I love that. The honeysucker trucks. Yeah. That's cute, Curtis.
Yeah. And that sludge will go wherever sludge does go. into the outer upper. Yeah. But in the case of Battery Park City, it's going to be agricultural quality sludge that could be
reused as irrigation
or turned into fertilizer.
Uh-huh.
So even though there are dark sides to being green, there are
some success stories in there.
There are real potentials.
It's like everything else in all of what we talk about here on Heritage Radio Network, whether it's agriculture, aquaculture, farming, that's redundant, but buildings, it's never black or white. There's always a trade-off. And I think, to go back to my point earlier, that this is a country that loves its extremes, and it's either got to be black or it's got to be white. It's got to be Republican or it's got to be Democrat, and either side is vilifying the other. In fact, there are elements from both sides that deserve notice.
As you know, because you've read my book, The Accidental Yankee.
Yes.
America is a country that reaches a medium ground. Thank you for joining us on Burning Down the House.
It's been a pleasure.
Has been TechServe, and we'll come back and we'll talk about more about being green in future programs. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
I'm sure you will.